It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, when you're planning a vacation, there are a lot of ways to do it. Using a travel agent, booking directly through hotels and airlines, and more. Our guest did an experiment to find out which way works best. First, in last week's state budget address, Governor Evers renewed his call to accept federal funds to expand Medicaid, known as Badger Care, in Wisconsin.
I've said all along we need to expand Medicaid in Wisconsin, and according to a recent Marquette Law poll, 62% of Wisconsinites agree. 82,000 more Wisconsinites will have access to affordable, quality health care coverage. And because we're accepting these federal dollars, we have the opportunity to invest in programs that improve health care access and affordability across our state.
But expanding Badger Care could be a tough sell, with some Republican lawmakers already speaking out against the idea. Our next guest joins us to give us an overview of Badger Care as it exists now and how an expanded program could impact state residents. Donna Friedsam is a distinguished researcher and the Health Policy Programs Director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. She also oversees the group Covering Wisconsin, which helps connect residents with insurance plans. Donna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, Donna, before we get into possible changes, can you remind us how Wisconsin under Governor Walker charted this kind of unique course on the nation when it came to Medicaid coverage for its residents?
Right. So Governor Walker chose, instead of the Affordable Care Act had outlined a plan that would allow states to expand Medicaid eligibility up to 138% of the federal poverty level, which is about $16,000 for an individual and about $32,000 for a family of four. And that would have, the federal government at the time would have paid for several years 100% of the cost for the coverage of those newly eligible people, and then slowly reduced the federal share to what it said would be a permanent 90% share, 10% state share, to cover these newly eligible people. Governor Walker did not take that that offer to expand to that level of eligibility, and instead said Wisconsin will cover its residents up to 100% of the federal poverty level instead, and it will direct people above that level to purchase insurance in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. And in doing so, the governor removed from eligibility some adults who did at the time have coverage under Badger Care. So adults, parents and caretaker adults who had been eligible up to two times the federal poverty level. So about 70 to 80,000 of those adults moved from Badger Care off of that eligibility and were directed to find coverage elsewhere. But at the same time, childless adults up to 100% of the federal poverty level gained eligibility. And so today we have about 145,000 of those childless adults, or actually adults without dependent children, who are enrolled in that coverage.
And now, what is Governor Evers proposing doing when it comes to taking Medicaid, federal Medicaid funds to expand Badger Care?
So there's a couple parts of this. One is that because Governor Walker did not participate in the Affordable Care Act expansion, the state was unable to get the federal participation financially. So the state did not get that 100% federal support in the first few years, and then the 90% support in the ongoing years for that expansion population. So it essentially lost out in, it turned out to be hundreds of millions of dollars that the state might have gotten if for the added people that were eligible under the expansion, the childless adults in particular that were added to eligibility. And in, so under the under an ACA expansion, the state would get that. Instead, what we had was the regular federal Medicaid share that we get for our Medicaid program, which is about 60% federal funding and 40% state funding.
So who in Wisconsin would feel the impact of the change that Governor Evers wants? Whose coverage would be affected?
Okay, well, let me just add, the other piece of this is, of course, not only increasing the federal share of payment, but increasing the eligibility for people beyond 100% of the federal poverty level up to the 138% of the federal poverty level. And as you heard Governor Walker's, in Governor Walker's speech that you played at the top of this segment,
Governor Evers.
Governor Evers' speech, He's saying it's about 80,000. The estimates are about 76 to 80,000 additional people would be eligible under this, and about half of those, in my estimate, would come from the uninsured, and another half would be moving from marketplace eligibility to Medicaid coverage.
Talking to Donna Friedsam from the UW Population Health Institute, looking at Governor Evers' call to accept federal Medicaid money to expand Badger Care coverage to more people here in Wisconsin. A couple background questions, Donna. The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, passed quite a while ago. Is this federal money still on the table? There wasn't an expiration date beyond which we couldn't take it for the first time?
The federal money is still available.
And if we were to take it, but this lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act in its entirety under a court in Texas, if that immediately, or if that were to eventually get rid of the Affordable Care Act completely, does that money then disappear?
Well, a lot of things are going to happen if that Texas lawsuit prevails. Most legal scholars do not believe that that Texas lawsuit is going to stand with the current holding. But if that does indeed happen, yes, the federal Medicaid expansion match will go away. So will all of the existing subsidies for marketplace plans that we have today, so over 200,000 existing Wisconsin residents who purchased their coverage through the marketplace, that will go away as well, in addition to the protections for pre-existing conditions and other protections that you've been hearing about over the last 6 months as the state has legislature has debated how to make sure that those protections continue if the Texas lawsuit does prevail.
In his budget address last week, Governor Evers said that accepting this federal money might do more than just provide more coverage. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
It means that we can invest in programs to address infant mortality and to encourage preventative care like cancer and STI screenings. It means we're going to put our money where our mouths are, literally, to ensure Wisconsin isn't among the worst states in dental care in the country. And it means we can expand access to substance abuse and mental health treatment, intervention, and stabilization, especially in our rural communities, for people who are in crisis.
Donna, connect the dots for us. Does he just mean that giving more people coverage means they'll have more access to those services, or does accepting this Medicaid funding allow the state then to put money into those specific coverage areas that he's talking about?
Right, it's the latter. So while indeed there would be more people gaining some coverage from the Medicaid expansion, what the governor there is referring to is that this Medicaid expansion will bring in about $320 million more in federal funding and free up the state funding that has been going toward supporting the adults without dependent children or the childless adults coverage that we previously expanded under Governor Walker's expansion that would now be funded under a federal Medicaid support plan. So with that freed up money, the governor in his budget is allocating those to several new programs, such as expanding dental access with the dental therapy programs and other dental programs, a women and infant health initiative, some mental and behavioral health initiatives, and the like.
We're talking to Donna Friedsam. She's a health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. She's with us to talk about Governor Evers' call to expand Badger Care in the state and how the program would look if the legislature agreed to its expansion. An open question at this point. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want the state to do this, to take more federal Medicaid money to expand Badger Care here in the state? What other kind of changes would you hope to see from what you've heard? Does this affect you? Would this affect you? Do you have a question for our guest about how this all goes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about Governor Evers' call to expand Badger Care in the state. It was an issue he campaigned on and one he talked about in his budget address last week. Our guest is Donna Friedsam. She's a health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Governor Evers' proposal to take more federal Medicaid money to boost Badger Care in Wisconsin, expand it to more people? Should lawmakers vote for it or against it? If you participate or have participated in Badger Care, please share your experiences and thoughts. And of course, you can ask questions of our guest as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Elena is with us in Madison. Elena, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wondered if your guest could speak a little bit more about that FMAP, which is that federal matching percentage that the Fed gives to states in Medicaid programs. And the reason I bring that up is because I think everyone sees the little memes that float around on Facebook and certainly hears all of the partisan talking points that make it sound as if state taxpayers alone foot the bill for Medicaid, for Badger Care, and that's simply not true in any state. There's that federal match is a really important part of Medicaid programs, and it's significant. So to say, I know that you touched really briefly that right now it's a 60-40 split in Wisconsin, but I think it would be important for people to really hear what that means, that that is federal money, not state taxpayer dollars, that are coming into that federal program, and that we would just be expanding that. And so you are freeing up taxpayer dollars to some of those really important issues that Governor Evers has mentioned. And I'll take my any comments off the air. Thanks.
Elena, thanks for the call. Donna, did you want to expand on that?
Well, it sounds like Elena made her point. We do get, under regular Medicaid programs, we get about a 60-40 match. And so when, you know, we grow our program, we get that same match, but under the ACE, under the Affordable Care Act expansion plan, we get for an ongoing basis, it turns out to be 90-10. Now, it's true that, you know, when we expand, we still have to put in our state share as well. So it does cost the state share to continue, but it brings in a substantial amount of federal dollars every time, you know, to cover most of the cost of adding people to the program. Now, it is fair to acknowledge that people who come in to the program through the Affordable Care Act marketplace also get subsidies for their coverage. And there's the debate that exists right now is with this group, 100 to 138% of the federal poverty level, are they better off getting their insurance through the marketplace at a highly subsidized level or under Medicaid expansion, in which case the state is getting the 90%, 100 to 90% federal match. And that's the big debate that we're going to see going on in the legislature right now. Is it better to keep them in the marketplace under the ACA, or is it better to have them in Medicaid?
How do we start to evaluate that debate before it happens? I know people are starting to try to understand that, maybe based on the experience of other states. Is that something we can really know until we dive in, whether the cost savings for the state are better under the current system or under Medicaid expansion?
Well, we're seeing a lot of conflicting information coming out over the last week or two. We've had debating studies being tossed around, and I think people need to be really careful about the way they use and consume information. But I will say that, you know, the straight dollars and cents to the state are pretty clear that a Medicaid expansion would save the state budget money. But the question is, overall, in terms of the overall expenditures to the state overall, the federal marketplace funds come into the state. They don't come to the state budget. So the question is really like a bigger question of, you know, some people would prefer that people have private sector coverage. They're not concerned about bringing in more money into the state budget, whereas other people will say, look, it'll cost us less to cover more people if we take this federal money, and also we can bring more money into the state budget. So it's a larger question. But if you're just asking me, do we bring in more, what brings in more money into the state budget, and how do we cover more people doing so, the math is pretty clear that that's through a federal Medicaid expansion. Again, though, there is that kind of philosophical debate about, but can we get people covered in the private sector, and some people prefer that we do it that way.
Thanks for that call, Elena, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Donna Friedsam from the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute about Governor Evers' call in his budget address to expand Medicaid coverage in Wisconsin, take more federal money for Medicaid to expand in the state our Badger Care program to more people in the state, a wider eligibility for that. Speaking of eligibility, Donna, a related issue, though not directly related to Medicaid expansion, there have been efforts to change eligibility to require work or training or things like that to people receiving these kind of benefits. Where do we stand on that right now?
So under Governor Walker's administration, there was something called a waiver request that was submitted to the federal government that asks that the state be able to waive certain requirements of federal law and regulation, and one of them is to require certain what's called work or community engagement activities of Medicaid members. And there were some other provisions in the waiver as well. People may recall a discussion around drug testing for eligibility, some things around taking a health risk assessment, certain reductions in premiums if people adhere to healthy behaviors and the like. That waiver was approved in the early November 2018, although the drug testing provisions were not approved. And so Governor Evers' administration is now left with the task of figuring out how to implement this waiver, although Evers' administration is not as interested in some of the policy components in this waiver. And you do see in Governor Evers' budget some requests, some budget items that are requesting to roll back some of the provisions within the waiver. So, but until those provisions are rolled back in some way, the administration will need to figure out how to implement the waiver as it has been approved.
Let's go back to our callers now. Dustin is with us in Ashland. Dustin, hello.
Hello. I just have a question. What are the new income requirements going to be for the new Medicare expansion? I know right now in the state of Wisconsin, it's $1,024 a month if you're working. I just moved over here from Minnesota this last June, and I had state health care over there, and the income requirements were a little higher. It was almost $1,700 a month, and I was just recently kicked off Badger Care. Are the income requirements going to go up for a single male or a single person living in the state of Wisconsin, or are they going to stay the same? And that's my question.
Dustin, thanks. Donna, you were addressing this a little earlier. What would this mean for someone in Dustin's position?
Right. Well, he's getting in exactly what the legislature is going to be debating under Governor Evers' budget proposal, because Governor Evers has proposed that the state adopt the same Medicaid expansion guidelines that Minnesota has, in which case he would see the income guidelines go to what Minnesota has, which would be 138% of the federal poverty level, or about $16,000 to $17,000 for an individual. But currently, our state, the income limit is 100% of the federal poverty level, which is $12,000 a year for an individual.
Dustin, thanks a lot for your call. Donna, one of the objections from Governor Walker and many Republicans when it came to Medicaid expansion was, okay, we take it now, things maybe look better for a couple of years, but there's uncertainty. We don't know if we can count on the feds to keep this money coming, and then all of a sudden, if they don't, we're left holding the bag. Is that a concern?
Yeah, that was something that was voiced quite extensively at the beginning. Now, I mean, I guess it's a concern to the degree that any federal program could go away in the future, road building programs or education programs or anything. It's never been a problem for state government to take any other federal program with the idea that a federal program might go away in the future. So I guess it's really a question of whether you want to apply that concern here. We do see that the state is capable of changing its eligibility criteria if it wants or needs to. So in 2014, the state government did roll back Badger Care eligibility for parents and caretaker adults from 200% of the federal poverty level to 100% of the federal poverty level in response to new federal opportunities to send people to the marketplace. And if indeed changes happened at the federal level where the federal match was no longer available, the state could choose to change its eligibility criteria again. And in fact, Maine, or I believe the state of Maine, structured its expansion law to say that if the federal money was no longer available, the state eligibility levels would revert back to prior levels. So I guess that would be my answer for you.
And Donna, in our last minute or so, we have a Democratic governor in favor of Medicaid expansion. He's setting poll numbers that look like they support him. Republican lawmakers opposed to it. As you look around the country, are you seeing a trend for more states over time to take this federal Medicaid money?
Oh, absolutely. There's 14 states remaining that have not participated in the Medicaid expansion, the federally structured Medicaid expansion. And in the November elections, there were ballot initiatives such that Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah, three red states, the voters voted to expand Medicaid expansion. And we'll see how those expansions actually take effect, because the legislatures are now in the process of trying to figure out how to actualize those directives, and there's quite a bit of debate going on, Utah in particular, about whether or how that's going to materialize. But there's no doubt that there's been an ongoing trend toward expanding the Medicaid program for the states to take advantage of these federal funds that are available.
Donna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Donna Friedsam, Health Policy Programs Director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. She joined us today to talk about Governor Evers' call to expand Badger Care in a state budget address last week using federal Medicaid money, the impact that expansion could have for Wisconsin residents if it's approved by state lawmakers. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers wants to hold off on closing Wisconsin's youth prison until new regional facilities are ready. We'll find out what state officials can learn from a new report on New York's experience with a similar overhaul. First, as winter continues to hold Wisconsin in its icy, snowy grip, how does a few days in sunny, warm Florida sound? Before you start buying plane tickets and making hotel reservations, consider what our next guest has to say. She did a little experiment recently to figure out the best way to go about booking a vacation, including booking directly from hotels and airlines, a travel agent, and some online options. She says the results may surprise you. Shivani Vora is a lifestyle and travel writer based in New York City. She talked to Central Time producer Bill Martins.
Before we get into the findings of your experiment, what are some important things we should keep in mind when planning a vacation?
Planning a vacation, I think, is where, I guess, you know, you want to go, right? Finding a destination, I think, is important. Booking your accommodations, planning activities, booking how you get there, definitely. The transportation, are you flying, are you driving? So figuring out how to get there.
So how many different ways are there to book a trip?
I think in the proliferation of an online world, there are many ways to book a trip. There's an endless number of travel sites that you can go to book trips, and I think that's the biggest proliferation we've seen in the space. You can certainly book direct. You can call up airlines directly. You can call up hotels directly. Or you could definitely use a travel agent. Or you can use, like I said, the online sites like Expedia's of the world.
Now, you planned a hypothetical vacation using four different methods, and then you compared the results. So what did this vacation look like, this hypothetical vacation?
Okay, so the hypothetical vacation is that I was going from Chicago, to Fort Lauderdale, and was staying at the Atlantic Hotel, which is a beachfront property in Fort Lauderdale. And I was with my family, so there was four of us. So that's what the trip was.
So what happened?
For four nights.
So what happened when you went directly through the hotel and the airline?
Well, I got a nice agent on the phone. I got a quote of $376 a night for an ocean view room, which was the basic category of room. And I found, you know, the agent I spoke with was really general, really friendly, very knowledgeable about the hotel. You know, tried to figure out, I said, I'm with my husband, I'm with my two kids, they're both under 12, is it going to be big enough? He knew a lot about it, the size of the room. He said, no, I think it's going to be big enough. You know, you have a balcony, you have a little kitchenette area. And in terms of flights, I found a bunch of flights. I went on AA. I'm a frequent, you know, I'm a part of their frequent flyer program. I try to fly them as often as I can. So I found a bunch of affordable flights, and I found the great one with great timing on AA.
Then you planned that same trip through a travel agent. Now, what did you find out going that route?
So he was able to get me a lower rate for the same level room. So it was $315 a night. So instead of $376 a night, so that was a savings right there.
Okay.
And he got me the same airfare. But he was able to get me a lot of extras. He got me a breakfast, which is big, because I think breakfast can add up to, you know, $100 or more for a family of four, depending on what you get. He said if there was an upgrade at the property that had space, that they would upgrade me to the next level. He got me an early check-in and a late check-out, which is really nice because, you know, they're not obligated to give you your room before 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And he got me a boat tour of Fort Lauderdale for all four of us. And he got me a welcome amenity, so either key lime tarts or chocolate-covered oranges, a sweet treat to look forward to.
Hey, that's cool. And then you also tried Expedia, which is, you know, basically an online aggregator that gives you prices on flights and rooms and car rentals and so on. What did that turn up?
So that was interesting, actually. I typed it in that I was looking for four people, and it showed the hotel as being sold out. So I knew that it wasn't actually sold out, you know, because I'd already done the travel agent and I'd already called the hotel directly, and I knew that they had several rooms available. So I said, this is weird. When I changed, I found the same American Airlines flight. But when I changed it and I said it's for two people, okay, it showed the room is available. So it wasn't letting me book that category of room for four people.
That's weird.
So it was, yeah, I was able to book it then. And the room worked out to be about $348 a night when I did it that way.
Okay, and then lastly, you went through Booking.com and Google Flights. So what kind of results did you get through them?
So the same room, $350, so somewhere right in the middle of the hotel directly and the travel agent. And then the same AA flight, that price was consistent all throughout.
We are talking with Shivani Vora, a lifestyle and travel writer in New York City. So it looks like the travel agent wins out here. I mean, did that surprise you?
Not me, I would say, because, you know, I've covered the travel agent, you know, space and the value that they can get you for a number of years now. And but I would say in general, it is very surprising that how many extras valued at several hundred dollars I was able to get through the travel agent. I think most people would be surprised by that because people think that travel agents are out and who really uses them anymore. But I certainly found that not to be the case, that here, you know, I got the most bang for my buck, so to speak, with a travel agent. And one other thing I should add about the travel agent is that he really knew the property. He hadn't stayed there. This was Jack Ezon of Embark. He hadn't stayed there, but several of his agents, colleagues, had stayed there. And they had said, you know, he knew that all entry-level rooms are not created equal. He said that if you get one ending in 12, you're going to get 75 more square feet of space.
Hey.
Which is a big deal, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, every little square foot counts when you're with kids, I think. People, they spread out.
Right.
And also, if I had any problems with flights, anything was delayed, which they often are, especially in winter, or there was a problem at the hotel, I would go to them. They would act as my representative. So those were two nice extras that I got right there, on top of the extras of the breakfast and the upgrade and the early check-in and the boat tour, which was a few hundred dollars, the boat tour.
Wow. Okay. So we're talking, again, we're talking about a pretty straightforward trip here. Again, I mean, family flies from Chicago to Fort Lauderdale. You stay in the hotel the whole time. However, in your piece, you wrote that you probably didn't need the hand-holding for such a simple trip. So I guess my question is, when does a travel agent make the most sense?
I would say that if you're really price shopping, why not go to a travel agent for any trip? I mean, I didn't need the hand-holding, but I needed the extras, right? I mean,
right.
Who doesn't need the extras? It's a very basic trip. I could have planned it on my own, but I got a lot more. So in that case, it absolutely made sense to use a travel agent. Absolutely.
And you also seem to think pretty highly of your travel agent in this case. So, and there are a lot of travel agents out there. How would you suggest we go about finding one who can make us just as happy as the one you worked with?
I think that, you know, just by simply interviewing travel agents, there's many different travel networks out there. Virtuoso has, you go on virtuoso.com. You know, you type in what you're looking for exactly. They match you with prospective agents, Signature Travel Network, the American Society of Travel Agents. If you just go on, I mean, you know, you come up with lists of people. You can find one in your area, you know, in your neighborhood if that's what you're looking for, or someone like if you're planning a trip to Italy or to Cambodia or whatever it is. Someone who's an expert in that destination, that's another way to go about it, too.
Okay.
So, there's lots of ways.
Sure. And I guess I'm also wondering if there are any rules of thumb as to when you might want to book directly through the airline or use one of those online services, or should we pretty much just plan on doing what you did in evaluating all our options?
I think that you should definitely evaluate all your options, right? You'd be silly not to price shop, especially when we as consumers are so spoiled for choice today.
Where's your next trip going to take you?
The Atacama Desert in Chile.
Ooh.
Spring break, yes.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Have a great time.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks
a lot.
Shivani Vora is a lifestyle and travel writer in New York City. She talked to Bill Martins about booking a vacation and her experiment to find out how to get the most bang for her buck. Coming up, folks in New York who studied the overhaul of their state's juvenile justice system have some advice for Wisconsin as we get ready to do the same thing. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, our guest says a labor strike is looking like a real possibility for the future of Major League Baseball. We'll find out why and when it might happen. First, Governor Evers says he wants to put the brakes on a plan to close northern Wisconsin's youth prison until new regional facilities are ready to go, however long that takes. Last year, then-Governor Scott Walker signed a bill to close the Lincoln Hills School for Boys and the Copper Lake School for Girls by 2021. Offenders would then be held in smaller state or county-run facilities closer to their homes. The move came after years of reported inmate abuse and mistreatment and concern about the safety of workers at the facilities. In the meantime, a new report from New York City may give Wisconsin officials some insight on how to make that transition. Vincent Schiraldi is a senior research scientist at Columbia University's School of Social Work, co-director of Columbia's Justice Lab, and former commissioner of probation for New York City. He's one of the authors of the Justice Lab report, Moving Beyond Youth Prisons, Lessons from New York City's Implementation of Close to Home. Vinny, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, a lot of similarities, not complete similarities to what we're doing in Wisconsin. Can you give us a quick before and after of what happened in New York City?
Sure. So the similarities are we had really bad state youth prisons. Kids were coming to harm. They cost too much money, and the outcomes were terrible, and there was a lot of racial disparity. So that all ought to sound familiar to folks in Wisconsin, because that's pretty much what's been happening with Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. And so what the mayor of New York, Mayor Bloomberg, went and toured one of the facilities, which was mostly empty but still fully staffed. That was a law in New York. It took a year to close a facility when it was empty. And this was right after the crash. So he was furious about it. Governor Cuomo was furious about it. They talked to each other and they said, okay, New York wants all of its kids back. New York City wants to take all of the kids out of state institutions and bring them back into the city to either put them home or in small local facilities. And so we passed legislation called Close to Home, and now New York City sends no kids to state custody. It's an 8.6 million person city, so a little bigger than the state of Wisconsin, and we have 100 kids total out of their home in a placement. Only 12 of those are locked placements.
So that's way fewer, as I understand it, right? What accounts for that difference in the number?
What, you know, it's interesting because I've watched this play out in Wisconsin because I was actually the expert for the ACLU on the suit against Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. And then afterwards, there was, you know, Act 185 that closed the facilities, the act you just described. In New York, what we did was we started with a conversation about what kids do we think need to be in a locked facility? What kids do we need to be in any facility? And what kids could be home if we had the kinds of resources that would help them make it at home without committing crimes and flourishing? That's not where Act 185 started. Act 185 said is, we have 150 kids in locked custody. How can we create beds around a state for them? That's a really important difference because it's sort of like fire-ready aim. You know, the notion that we're going to build beds rather than what makes these kids tick and what could make them succeed at home, that's a very different question than how many beds do we need and where are we going to put them.
What would that approach look like? What would look different? Granted, this is still in process now, but what would that approach have looked like maybe in Wisconsin if the question had been, what's the best way to house or keep kids at home rather than incarcerating them?
Right. So it's, by the way, it's about $180,000 per kid per year in state custody in Wisconsin. So it's not about we don't have enough money. The state is spending quite a bit of money on these young people. So what it would look like is, in many respects, it would be, since we're going to now wipe out Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake and start over, if I had $180,000 and every single one of these kids, how many of these kids would have to go to a locked facility and how many could be home with the kinds of services that would make it work? And when I was in Milwaukee the other day, that was essentially the question I was asking. And you could see that, well, for some of these kids, if I had half of $180,000, if I had a quarter of it, I could develop a pretty good program to supervise them, to help them finish school, to get them job skills, to help them kick their drug habit, whatever they were struggling with. I could do a lot of that for way less than $180,000, and that would mean at least some of those kids wouldn't have to be in a locked facility. At the end of the day, you'll still need some locked custody for them, but it could be significantly less if you took a look at the young people that were in Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, took a look at the best programs going on around the country, and figured out a way to make the match.
Vinny, I think a lot of people might be listening and thinking, well, hold on, if a kid ended up at Lincoln Hills in particular, they're one of the worst of the worst. We've got maybe other kids who other approaches are going to work for. These are the ones who, for public safety reasons, need to be incarcerated. Whether it's at a big place, a small place, we're safer with them locked up. What would you say to that point of view?
There is no question that some of the kids there need to be in some form of custody. No question in my mind. When I talk to your stakeholders, this is not me making it up for New York. When I talk to your stakeholders, it seemed to me that if they had flexible money, like will be freed up when you close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, they could do it differently. Same was true in New York. None of my judges, if you walked up to my judges before Close to Home passed and said, which of the 500 kids shouldn't be locked up? They would say, none of them. We only put the kids there that needed to be locked up. But then once we changed the conversation and said, okay, Your Honor, we have money now to buy really robust programming. We had decent programming, but we can really up the ante on that. How about now? Well, then the conversation changed. Like, oh, and if I know somebody's really going to be watching this kid and really going to be working with them to turn their lives around, then, yeah, some of those kids don't have to be locked up. And we found it. You know, 4 out of 5 of them didn't have to be locked up in New York. We went from 500 to 100. And I don't know what the number would be in Milwaukee, but when I spoke with your stakeholders, they were interested in that kind of approach, having the money follow the kids instead of just going bed-for-bed replacement on what currently exists.
Talking to Vincent Schiraldi from Columbia University's Justice Lab, talking about New York's experience closing its larger juvenile corrections facilities, moving to smaller and alternative programs, and trying to find lessons for Wisconsin. The current state of debate, Vinny, is that the timing, it seems like. We had a deadline. Right. Governor Evers and some of the lawmakers behind the original plan say, okay, we can extend that. There's an argument over how much. Drawing from New York's experience, what do you think of our timeline here?
Yeah, well, I mean, the timeline's problematic because it's only a timeline for building beds. It's not a timeline for saying what should the whole continuum of care look like for kids. So I don't think Governor Evers slowing it down is the worst thing in the world, but only if you use that time to actually do something. If you basically say, let's get our stakeholders in the room, let's get the judges, the prosecutors, the cops, the defense attorneys, the community, the education people all in a room and say, all right, here's what our 89 kids, it's all you got, by the way. It's not like a million kids. Here's what the 89 young people from Milwaukee look like. Here's what troubles them. Here's what makes them tick. What portion of these do we really feel like, look, we got to have these in a locked building? And what could we imagine being home with their parents or with their grandmother with wraparound intensive services? If you could have that conversation and come to consensus, and we were able to do that, and I strongly suspect, having met your stakeholders, that they could do that, then you're real close to a plan right there. And that took us a little over a year to come up with that plan. And once we had that plan, implementation took half a year.
Now, suppose we don't do most of the stuff you're talking about. All we do is take the youth from these facilities, the big facility up north, move them closer to home in a smaller facility. I mean, is that in and of itself an improvement?
Certainly. There's almost nothing worse than Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, right? So they're really bad facilities. The kids were on lockdown. You know, one out of five kids was on lockdown 23 hours a day. Now, I know it's gotten better than that, but it was truly awful to watch kids 23 hours a day locked in their rooms, and then when they were out of their rooms, cuffed hand and foot, shuffling through the hallways. It was truly nauseating. So yes, I would imagine that the local facilities would be better than that. But you're not going to make this watershed change anytime soon again. And the only time you ever really get to capture big money from closing or downsizing facilities is a moment like this. You take 10 kids out of Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, you save virtually nothing. And if you build a facility in Milwaukee, same thing will be true. It's when you're really downsizing numbers and saying we're going to go from this to 60 or 40 or 30 or 20. Every time you do that and you build and staff something smaller, that's when you're able to capture money and use it to help young people turn their lives around. They are not turning themselves around in most of these locked facilities. And despite the best intentions of your current stakeholders, everybody thought Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake was going to be a good place when they built it, trust me. And that, putting kids in locked custody is generally not going to help turn their lives around. But some of those in-home family service programs and community programs, they really can help kids start a new life.
In our last 20, 30 seconds, a quick message to the governor and lawmakers as they consider this issue, Vinny.
You know, a lot of us think that we need these locked facilities to keep us safe. When New York moved all the kids back to New York City, crime plummeted. It dropped more in the 4 years after we started close to home than in the 4 years before. It dropped more in the 4 years after we started close to home in New York City than it did for the rest of the state, which didn't do close to home. So it's not just a feel-good program. It was really good for public safety as well.
Vinny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Vincent Schiraldi, senior research scientist at Columbia University School of Social Work, co-director of Columbia's Justice Lab, and former commissioner of probation for New York City. We talked to him about his report he co-authored on the overall of New York City's juvenile justice system, and what Wisconsin officials might be able to learn as they close the Lincoln Hills Copper Lake Youth Prison in northern Wisconsin. The plan is to move the inmates to smaller government-run facilities that are closer to their homes. As we heard, our guest said, we need some more fundamental changes along the way, too. Looking for a job? Here's an opening. The company Mondelez International has an opening. It's part-time, about $14 an hour. You'd have to relocate to the UK. So what? Well, that's the company that makes Cadbury chocolate, Oreo, Toblerone, and other candy and cookies. As reported by the Smithsonian Magazine, they're looking for a group of taste testers. Rachel Vasquez is in the studio. What kind of taste tester job would be best for you? Would you jump on this, probably chocolate tasting job?
I think I could do that job. I guess my question is, I could do it if it's like a quality assurance thing, but I don't want to taste new flavors of things like Oreos. No.
Not the like salmon flavored Oreo or whatever they're coming up with next.
No, okay. I was imagining like, what if they did like a Cadbury egg that was savory, like egg flavored? Oh. Terrible.
Okay. Now, what would be your dream taste testing job?
I think I would be probably the most satisfied by a Cheetos and or Cheez-Its tasting job.
Wow. How many different flavors are there of those to be tasting?
Well, Cheez-Its, there's a lot. There's probably like a whole aisle worth in the grocery store.
A world I haven't explored. You'd think you'd get sick of eating donuts every day. Hasn't happened yet for me, so I think that's probably where I'd go with that. So we won't compete with each other when we apply for these.
You have all the donuts.
By the way, for this job, full training will be provided to develop your taste buds and the specific vocabulary required to communicate your opinions. So sign up. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.